Welcome today to an interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I am conducting an exclusive interview with the multiple international award-winning Adam Cole, leading entrepreneur, top executive, and senior innovator. Adam, you have a remarkable career with so many outstanding contributions in a number of fields. Thank you for sharing your considerable expertise, deep accumulated insights, and wisdom with our audience.
Why, thank you, Stephen, for those kind words. You interview so many brilliant leaders in our industry who cumulatively have shared an enormous wealth of expertise and rich personal experiences. It's a genuine pleasure and an honor for me to have the chance to give something back.
Adam, can you profile how you got into computing and what triggered your interest?
Yes, I had an opportunity to play with my first real computer, a Commodore PET. Remember those? That was when I was in grade 4. I'll never forget. My father was a teacher, and his school received one of the first personal computers in the Toronto School Board. I skipped a day of school to see this miracle machine. It was love at first sight. I suppose I'm still a geek at heart. I remember my father writing a simple program, 10, print to Adam, 20, go to 10. And I was mesmerized as the screen filled up with my name. Today we take it for granted, but 30 years ago, state-of-the-art was flashing LEDs and toggle switches. The closest most people had come to a computer at that time was a four-function calculator, and that was impressive.
Now, it's interesting that you talk about flashing LEDs and so forth as a sort of a basic computer, but I just spent a week with Kelly Gottlieb judging at the Intel Science and Engineering Fair, which is the only international pre-collegiate science fair, and it's the world's largest. And, of course, he was working with computers back in 1947, so can you imagine the progress that we made since then, till even when you were working with computers, to know?
It's an amazing industry, and I look forward to seeing the next 30 years.
So what three experiences most shaped your life and work?
Well, that is easy. Getting married and having my two daughters. I'm surrounded by three of the most wonderful ladies who inspire me, amaze me, teach me and remind me of the goodness of humanity on a daily basis. Although my wife will later chastise me for the sappy comment. Now, coming up with a third experience, that's more challenging. My life has been full of rich experiences, but none so profound that it stands out amongst the rest. While on the theme of people, I could summarize a significant, but not acute, life-shaping experience as the sum of all people who have influenced me. To convert that into a message with values to our listeners, you cannot overestimate the influence of corporate culture on the quality of what a company produces. I'm a huge proponent of leadership by example.
So past, present, and future, name someone who inspires you, and why is it so?
Stephen, unless you plan on taking me on a Dickens-esque trip to the future, I think I'll constrain my response to the past and present. There's one person who immediately comes to mind. I've known you, Stephen, for several years now, and I know that you are truly humble, so this will probably embarrass you, but you must promise me not to edit this out. You're one of the most accomplished individuals I know. I've joked with you for years that you live in a world with 50-hour days, and you spend so much of that time giving back to the community, helping others, promoting our industry, and the adoption of professionalism within IT. You have an enormous impact in Canada and in the international arena. And yet, you do most of your great work behind the scenes by promoting others, just as you are doing with this podcasting series. I could go on for hours about what you have done and continue to do that inspires me. What I really look forward to is when you turn the microphone around and allow someone to interview you for this series. Another really big source of inspiration is not a person per se, although he does have a name, Ted, Ted.com. To the listening audience, if you're not already familiar with TED, I strongly encourage you, no, I implore you, to put aside an hour and get to know TED. The genesis of TED was to spread ideas in technology, entertainment, and design. Today, tickets to TED event are in such demand that they resell on eBay for upwards of $30,000. What makes TED so amazing is the organizers bring together the most fascinating, thought-provoking individuals and then challenge them to give the speech of their life in 20 minutes. There's so many excellent inspirational individuals on TED, but one who really stands out for me is Benjamin Zander. He covers a lot in his 20 minutes, yet it's his passion that really gets to me.
You know, you mentioned the TED conference, and there's a series of videos that are available just by going to their site. So I would agree with you. That's a remarkable series, a remarkable conference, and just a really kind of interesting series of ideas that are presented. Adam, over your distinguished career, what are your top lessons you want to share with the broad audience?
There's so many great lessons out there. I've gone through a computer science undergraduate and an MBA, and yet the most important lessons come from the real world. Let's talk about some of my favorites. The three P's, people, process, product. The interface is the system. Perfection is the enemy of good enough. Communication is an art, and context is king. First, the three P's of IT projects, and I use product in place of technology to give us that nice mnemonic. Very simply, in any IT project, the technology is only one component. Most projects can succeed with weak technology. However, not providing sufficient attention to the people and process aspects can be fatal. For example, the Canadian Gun Registry. It's a simple solution from a technology perspective. However, in the wake of the scandal, which is a process and governance issue unto itself, we have learned that Julian Fantino, the Ontario Police Commissioner, and Sheila Fraser, the Canadian Auditor General, both take issue with the registry because it fails to take into account people. Individuals don't register guns if they plan to use them for criminal enterprise, nor does it take into account process. The program never intended to collect data to gauge its effectiveness and had no way of showing that it was minimizing risk to the public. Conversely, when you do pay attention to people and processes, you can elevate technology solutions to incredible heights. And Apple is a master of this. They were not the first to come up with an MP3 player. However, their attention to how people want to use such a device and their fastidious attention to simplicity and elegance led, of course, to the insane success of the iPod. Similarly, Apple looked at the process people used to purchase, store, share, and organize their music libraries. This led to iTunes, which not only solves a business problem, but it's been another wild success for Apple.
Interesting. Now tell me about the interface as a system. It sounds very Marshall McLuhan to me.
Exactly. McLuhan may be most famous for his quote, "The medium is the message." An information technology system analogy would be, "The interface is the system." It is about the context of interaction and how important that is relevant to the content. Again, we can look to Apple's iPod as an example. Their emphasis on usability and their simple four-button click wheel propelled them to market dominance over products which were technically far more advanced. Facebook, as another example, has been stealing market share from MySpace since its inception, largely due to cleaner and more inviting interface. In the retail world, it is accepted that people are drawn to what looks good over what is good. In clothing, you look first to what is appealing before looking at the fabric. In consumer electronics, countless studies have shown that devices which are complicated to use fare less well than simple ones. Think about buying a fax machine for a non-technical friend. Recently, some sectors in technology have been really starting to get this. In particular, top consumer-oriented websites have made tremendous progress in attention to their usability and interfaces. And it makes sense. As a consumer, do you wish to spend your time browsing an attractive, intuitive website or a website with a clunky interface? What if you knew that the clunky website was running on better servers and the database architecture had won all sorts of awards? Most people wouldn't even make that a consideration, even if they were armed with that knowledge. And this leads to one of those proverbial bees in my bonnet. Business systems, particularly enterprise systems, tend to over-engineer the back end, and yet usability is treated as the poor cousin. Even in mission-critical systems where the back end must perform flawlessly, usability requires far more attention than it currently receives. The Chernobyl meltdown was exacerbated because the control panel UI was not clear. Atomic Energy Canada's Therac 25 anti-cancer radiation machine is infamous for killing a number of its patients it was meant to protect, in part because of, yes, you guessed it, ambiguous user interface messages. These killer flaws are clear examples of the harm of not fully considering usability. But what about the millions and billions of dollars spent every year on run-of-the-mill business systems which fail outright, are rejected by their users, constrain productivity, and simply fail to provide maximum ROI? I can easily trace many of my most successful solutions to following Apple's lead and paying fastidious attention to usability. We started this topic with a McLuhan quote, and I'll wrap it up with another excellent quote. "You know you've reached perfection in design, not when there's nothing left to add, but when there's nothing left that can be removed."
That's interesting, and it's interesting that you bring up the Apple products, and, you know, their chief designer has indicated, you know, largely he continues to simplify, and that's kind of his motto, so it kind of ties in with that. And it kind of reminds me of my interview with Chuck Thacker, where his wife commented to him that, the whole thing is that they're just, if it's not seamless or fully transparent, then it's just not really good enough. So that's great. Now, can you describe what you mean by perfection is the enemy of good enough?
Perfection is the enemy of good enough. This follows nicely on our previous thread of over-engineering. In software development, I'm a firm believer in the philosophy of agile. Many small iterations, continuous incorporation of user feedback, and a key focus on providing value as quickly as possible. In some systems, like the Chernobyl reactor control system, there's no choice but perfection on version 1. However, in most business systems, there's a novel element, frequently many novel elements. There's always a gap between the theory during design and the reality of what is delivered. Many small iterations help eliminate that gap and continuously align what is being built to what is desired. I have a doctor friend who built a small public surveillance network. In healthcare, public surveillance is used to spot health or more appropriately illness trends, and also often provides rich research data. The surveillance project started as a small grassroots project on a shoestring research grant. It quickly proved itself, even though there was no integration with the pilot doctor's electronic medical records. However, the system demonstrated its value and potential and is continuing to grow. When something is not designed properly, it is prioritized and addressed accordingly. Meanwhile, if this network continues to show success, then the integration with the electronic medical records will occur as it becomes a natural priority. This type of approach allows a program to follow an evolutionary path. The more novelty, the more innovation, and the more uncertainty in a software development project, the more sense it makes to follow this type of path. Practically speaking, this leads to better alignment with the users and project objectives, as well as cost effectiveness due to early course corrections. If my friend had waited until the specifications and transport bus in healthcare, the HIL, was ready to integrate with the doctor's electronic medical records, he would be waiting for years.
I see, and I guess this kind of ties into what Colin Powell in his sort of P4070 rule. Well, you mentioned some other top lessons. Can you touch on these?
Yes, let's see. I mentioned that communication is an art. Many problems, not just in IT, and business problems, can be traced back to simple miscommunication or communications breakdown. There's a poster that I love, which follows me around and is always tacked up on the wall wherever I work. The poster is divided into 9 frames. Each frame shows some form of boat with a brief caption. The first frame shows a simple sailboat and says what the client requested. The next frame shows a luxury ocean yacht and says what sails described. Another frame shows a cruise ship and says what the client paid for. And the next frame shows an empty ocean and says what was documented. And yet another frame shows a leaky life raft and says the support that was provided. I think this is a great poster, as it really underscores the challenges in communicating, especially the many subtle yet critical nuances. The humor in this poster, of course, is that everyone can relate to these misinterpretations. IT has for years carried the stigma of not listening to, not aligning to the business. I don't necessarily believe that is the case, but nonetheless, the response has been to create many layers of documentation. For example, the noble intent of specifications documentation is to ensure there is a common understanding. Sometimes that even works. However, frequently, this documentation acts as a layer of abstraction between the business and the development team, when what we really need is to avoid artificial obstacles and encourage as much direct and ongoing dialogue as possible. My final top lesson is context is king. For example, there are projects where rigorous documentation makes sense. Our earlier Chernobyl example fits the bill. And then there are cases where excessive documentation is a hindrance. I probably don't need to give an example of this, as everybody I talk to in IT has been involved in projects where documentation is done for the simple sake of keeping our pulp and paper industry healthy. The point is, judgment is a valuable attribute.
So what factors make for effective communications in writing?
That's easy, Stephen. I can summarize it in 2 simple points. Know your audience and be prepared.
How does one become successful at consulting?
Stephen, that's an excellent question. I immediately think of my earlier response about context being king. Everybody is unique and has their own strengths and weaknesses. Know your strengths, play to them, and be transparent about where you are not strong. Or better yet, know individuals who can complement your weaknesses and work with them as appropriate. Of course, identifying a niche and being able to fill it better than anyone else helps. For me, when I started my consulting business, that niche was attention to customer service and providing clear business value. A dozen years ago, I identified this as a niche, and my business rapidly grew from myself to over 15 employees and 3 partners. Today, the industry has evolved and matured, and customer service and business value are no longer gaps, but rather the cost of doing business.
Adam, you have a long and remarkable history of global contribution through nonprofit organizations, including winning awards for this work. Why should members of our audience get involved?
There's so many good reasons to get involved and volunteering in extracurricular work. As the saying goes, the one constant in IT is change. It's impossible to keep on top of current trends if your horizons are limited to your work at the office. When my training budget was frozen a couple of years ago, I encouraged my staff to join user groups and get involved in the IT community. In retrospect, I think hour for hour and dollar for dollar, one gets more value from this than from formal training. This, of course, is on top of contributing your expertise to worthwhile cause, developing expertise in areas you may not be able to at the office. For me, that was board experience, and meeting new people. Oh, the list goes on.
So part of that contribution sort of sphere is sometimes you can get into this idea of professionalism. So does professionalism matter in IT, and what does professionalism mean, and why should we care?
Yes, professionalism absolutely matters. Let me turn that question around. Would you want somebody working for you who is not a professional? So the real question is, what does it mean to be a professional? In other industries, such as teaching, medicine, accounting, professionalism means to keep your skills current, to adhere to a code of ethics, and practicing your skills within society's intrinsic morals, acknowledging when you don't have the expertise for a given task. I would also add that it means working constructively, being fair and honest and decent, striving to the mission and vision of the organization you're working for, and confronting others who do not adhere to these principles. Professionalism matters because it cumulatively provides the employer and society confidence in the work being conducted.
Now, you teach postgraduate courses and you have worked on your postgraduate studies in business. What useful tips can you pass on from your work and your studies?
You get out what you put into it. It's really that simple. If you're considering investing your money in a postgraduate program, be prepared to invest your time as well.
So you talk about investing your time, and in your course of your executive MBA studies, what does that mean per week?
On a typical week, it's about 20 hours, give or take. The one nice thing about the online program is you can defer hours on weeks where you're exceptionally busy to weeks where you have more time and more flexibility.
And then because you teach postgraduate courses, what's the time in terms of preparation? So what's the ratio between prep time and class delivery time?
That was a bit of a shock to me. The ratio of prep time to class time is probably about 3 or 4 to 1. I suspect this ratio gets a little more friendly as time progresses.
Yeah, perhaps if you teach in an area that's non-IT in an area that's not moving very rapidly, right? So let's say mathematics or something like that, which are fairly static. But I think in really highly sort of churning industries or in topic areas that have a lot of movement, then there's probably that 3, 4, or even 5 to 1, and that's a constant. Adam, you have launched successful companies. Can you describe what is required to be an entrepreneur by using one of your companies as an example?
Well, Stephen, I launched my first company shortly after university. At the time, I had no major responsibilities and no family, so risk and time constraints are not serious concerns. I learned far more running that business than anything in school, including the MBA or at other jobs. And in an entrepreneurial context, learning is a euphemism for a financial sting. Very early on, when the company was just me, I listed out a set of objectives. Initially, I had about 30, but I whittled it down to a core 3 or 4 that I felt were most important. Customer service, return on investment for my customers, my target staff size, and my target company revenues. For each of these, I had target numbers. For years, I had this taped above my monitor. This is a good way to keep focused on the big picture, especially when you're drowning in minutia. I've also had the opportunity to work for others in small companies and in some of the largest companies, and also in academia. My advice would be, if you wish to be an entrepreneur and avoid the expensive lessons, the best education you can have would be a management position at a small entrepreneurial company. Large companies and academia just don't give you a true feel for the dynamic nature and the many hats you need to wear as an entrepreneur. And of course, you also need to define your niche. Avoid being too opportunistic, as focus and consistency is important to growth. Know what distinguishes you from the competition, but don't obsess over the competition. That will only distract you. Be a good listener. Be excellent at networking and as a salesperson. And always hire people who complement your weaknesses and are smarter than you.
I guess this goes into this idea of also avoiding groupthink, right? So sometimes people have a tendency to try to hire people who are sort of exactly like them, but then you don't get the necessary tension in the company, and that could lead to not achieving the kind of success that you should have. What are your thoughts on that?
You're absolutely right. Tension in that context can be an excellent way to learn and a motivator, as well as what I found personally worked for me was my background being in technology and mathematics and not in the business side. By bringing on individuals who did have the business background, they were really able to complement my weaknesses, and together we were far more effective.
You know, a few weeks ago, in fact, a week before last, I met with Bill Miller, and Bill Miller is a professor emeritus in both business and computing at Stanford. In fact, he set up the computing program at Stanford, and he's won just every conceivable honor that you can think of. And he's known every U.S. president for something like the last 30 years personally. In fact, he even knows the leadership of in other countries as well, and on a very sort of personal basis. But he sort of gave this idea when I talked to him. He said that maybe one of the best ways that you can grow your entrepreneurial skills or your leadership skills or your management skills is to volunteer for a nonprofit organization and then take the helm, you know, get on the board, take some kind of leadership position. And sort of distilling down what he said is that if you can manage and lead one of those organizations, you can lead any organization. Now, I know that you've had leadership positions in nonprofit organizations. What are your thoughts on that?
Again, I absolutely agree with you, and both you and I know this. You far more than me. I know you're involved in a number of volunteer organizations, and myself from volunteering, and as I mentioned earlier, sitting on the board of directors, that was an excellent experience for me. You meet a number of individuals. You get exposed to a number of different problems. The individuals who are volunteering on the board with you are all coming from their own companies with their own experiences, which you're more than happy to share. You develop a great network. I'm unfamiliar with the person who you mentioned, but it's obviously a bright individual with some excellent advice.
Now, Adam, you led a department with 100% score in customer satisfaction, and you're the first to attain this remarkable achievement and one of the top global companies. Really, it's just a remarkable achievement. Can you share with us how others can model your performance?
I have to be honest. I believe that I became so focused on delighting the customer at my own company, that it was one of our core beliefs, that it had become an intrinsic behavior. Having said that, for anyone leading an IT department or project, customer satisfaction is a noble objective, so it's worth taking a moment to consider some of the key behaviors. We can start with treat everybody with respect. This is where your mother's advice comes in handy. Treat everyone as you would want to be treated yourself. By doing so, you earn credit, which is redeemable when the inevitable problems arise. I had a colleague who was brilliant but miserable. When she goofed up, she was afforded no slack. Avoid problems in the first place. Many potential problems can be proactively managed by communicating directly and frequently, being transparent, listening, and constructively confronting problems as early as possible. You can also recognize people's strengths on your teams and understand that generally everybody wants to succeed. Give them the tools and support to succeed. As a manager, one of the most important jobs you have is to clear obstacles for your team. In IT, that typically means dealing with the politics and bureaucracy so that your team members can focus on what they do best and what they've been hired to do. And what likely has the greatest impact is leading by example. Nothing motivates or conversely discourages a team like the behaviors they see in their direct supervisor. I worked in an environment that had a call center. The management regularly made disparaging comments about the clientele and then wondered why customer ratings of the call center was less than stellar.
Well, those are great points, and I'm sure the audience will get a lot of value from them. Now, let's kind of turn our attention to a little bit more of a technical side. What would be your recommendations for effective software development?
Another great question, Stephen. Right now, I'm very fascinated with the video game industry. From a technology perspective, video games are amazingly complex. They have intuitive and compelling user interfaces. They have immersive graphics, advanced artificial intelligence, three-dimensional sound, highly engaging gameplay. They have massively multiplayer universes. fantastic true-to-life physics, cross-platform compatibility. They're often resilient to network communications, and they have amazing reliability. These are all highly desirable attributes, even by the standards of the most financially endowed business projects. What makes this possible in a video game, yet elusive in business applications, which often have budgets an order of magnitude larger? There are a few relatively low-risk behaviors which a business world could adopt from the video games world. Application construction kits, similar to Unreal and id, and countless other game engines which dramatically speed development. A focus on results over processes, and engaging in fun work environments. I'd like to see business developers starting to experiment with these practices and share their stories. Another thing we in the business world can learn from the gaming world is about customer engagement. Social media as a genre attributes much of its success to engaging their users using gaming mechanics. It's a bit of a misnomer, but we'll go with it. Gaming mechanics deals with the psychology of what draws and holds a user to game, specifically what makes a game addictive. Common techniques include experience points, leveling up, achievements, feedback, exchange, random rewards, customization, and gifting. There are plenty of excellent resources on the web for building social media applications which incorporate these techniques. Once again, I'd like to see the developers in the business world start adopting strategies from the gaming world. And just in case you think I'm crazy, Zynga, the developers of Farmville, a simple little game for Facebook, is currently estimated to be worth $3 billion, and they won't even be celebrating their third birthday until July. Farmville is a leader in demonstrating the potential of gaming mechanics.
You know, Adam, that's fascinating that you mentioned sort of using gaming as a model and taking lessons from that and applying it to sort of business applications. In fact, it's the first time I've heard anybody say that. But when you go over all the kind of the attributes defining gaming, you're absolutely right. So I just love that. So since we're on this kind of idea of gaming, have you heard of the Project Natel from Microsoft?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's Microsoft, they have some just absolutely fascinating things going on with that project, and I know you're far more familiar with it than I am, and it's such a fascinating project. It's, I'm sure the audience would appreciate if you took a minute just to describe some of what's involved in Natel.
Well, I think it sort of kind of ties into, you know, when I indicated that in my discussion with Chuck Thacker, who won the Turing Award this year, he indicated, his wife commented that, you know, there's all these computers in their car, but you can't see them. They're seamless. And she says that's where how everything should be. And Chuck is saying that really is ultimately what the way it should be. The use of computers should be totally seamless. You shouldn't even know that they exist, right? And so I guess that's what Project Natel is trying to, you know, produce that kind of experience where you're interacting with characters and with your computer, but it's done in a very natural way. There's no, you don't have to type things on a keyboard. You don't have to use a mouse. You just work and act naturally. You don't carry things in your hand and the computer responds, and you can game that way. You can walk through virtual worlds. So I think it's going to produce kind of a whole paradigm shift in terms of not only gaming, but just the whole user interface aspect. And you earlier talked about that, right?
Yes, and I agree completely. There was a period, oh, probably 20, 25 years ago, where the only way we interacted with the computer was through the keyboard. And the introduction of the mouse led to graphical user interfaces and the metaphor of icons and symbols. And that was a significant paradigm shift. And now what we see with the multi-touch displays and going further to the interfaceless interfaces, if I can say it that way, where the computer via camera, such as in Natel, looks at what you're doing and interprets your motions. This type of seamlessness, it's going to introduce a whole new paradigm shift, as you were alluding to.
So, Adam, what are the top challenges and solutions in healthcare technologies?
Well, this is the perfect follow-on question to the earlier discussion on gaming in the business community. The healthcare IT industry is currently struggling to build systems such as EMRs, which are electronic medical records, and PHRs, personal health records, which engage doctors and patients respectively, and ideally motivate behavioral changes. This is fertile territory for gaming mechanics. Imagine you had just been diagnosed with diabetes. Your doctor tells you you need to make a number of lifestyle changes, such as losing weight, exercising regularly, and cutting back on alcohol consumption. Experience suggests that you will be motivated at first, but quickly revert back to old habits. Some of the strategies from gaming mechanics that could help you successfully stick to your new lifestyle would be experience points, similar to the Concept 2 Rowing Online Team Challenge, or SportyPal GPS Tracker, which runs on smartphones and allows you to track via GPS your movements and compare running, hiking, walking, and biking routes, as well as uploading this information and tracking it online. There's also collaboration, exchanges, and motivation, such as what can be found at the amazing patient support website, Patients Like Me, and achievements, which are virtual trophies earned by reaching certain milestones, such as exercising 3 days a week for a month or losing 5 pounds, etc. Gifts, such as a pedometer or movie ticket from your healthcare team for starting or maintaining a new healthier lifestyle. There's no doubt in my mind that we will see these techniques adopted somewhere in the healthcare space soon. And as they're adopted, there's no doubt that it will be successful and it will be mimicked across the healthcare world. Another interesting phenomenon is the adoption of checklists. In 2001, a doctor at Johns Hopkins Hospital introduced a simple 5-point checklist in the OR. Pilots have been using checklists for years to avoid making silly errors in routine processes. This doctor felt surgeons could benefit from the same. 3 years later, the state of Michigan had adopted several simple checklists in their ICUs. Over an 18-month statewide pilot, the state of Michigan had saved $175 million and over 1,500 lives. This is not a technology solution. It is a simple process solution. The relevance in this conversation is the Liberals in Ontario were accused about a year ago of squandering $1 billion on the Ontario eHealth Agency. While eHealth initiatives across the country continue to demonstrate less than stellar results, what other opportunities are being missed, such as checklists? To be respected as true business partners, technologists need to put the business first and prioritize projects based on their total business impact.
I see. I guess that goes down to this whole idea of aligning IT with business strategy and organizational goals. And, you know, sometimes you have students who are out there and they're wondering, well, why do I have to be effective in communications? Why do I have to have domain knowledge? Why should I have any kind of understanding of the business of the organization? And they sometimes think that they should only concentrate on the technology and sort of the geek part of it, not realizing that's kind of a holistic kind of approach is better. What are your thoughts on that?
Again, you see, very succinctly put that. It's critical if you're going to be working in the business world to understand the business and to understand the context and the objectives of the companies that you're working for.
I guess this also ties into this concept of professionalism in IT and professionalism programs, because they embody what I sometimes call the beta attributes, and that's business skills and domain knowledge, the ability to focus on the customer user experience, making sure that that user experience is a priority, and then having communications, project management, and interpersonal skills, and then the last component being the technology aspect, having some technical competency and skills. So really, it's a combination of all of those that makes for a complete professional, and those are embodied in a lot of professional certification programs.
Yes.
So, Adam, what are the software development and platform issues that need to be addressed in business?
Well, as a software development industry, we need to achieve more reliable results. Depending on what metrics you use and how you define success, business systems fail at an alarming rate. Over 60% of large IT projects do not meet the success criteria, and up to 70% of systems are rejected. According to a Standish study performed in the early 2000s, 1/4 of software projects are canceled in any given year to a tune of $70 billion, and 80% of development costs go to fixing flaws before the software is even put into production. This comes back to some of the points that you were just making about professionalism and understanding the holistic picture. Platforms can certainly help improve these numbers. I'm a fan of high-level platforms which provide rich business development frameworks and require minimal to no coding to accomplish many standard business tasks. For example, CRM, Customer Relations Management, and BPM, Business Process Management, solutions can handle out-of-the-box user and account management, registries, contact history, multiple integration interfaces, dynamic forms and dynamic workflow processes, case management. You get the idea. Armed with these modules, IT and the business can work collaboratively and quickly get a prototype application up without having to worry about any of the common plumbing. For many business needs, this is all that is required. Businesses that adopt these platforms discover many automation efficiencies. Of course, these tools require new skills and a new mindset on how to leverage technology to approach business problems. Ironically, failure to implement these platforms properly is similar to the overall failure rate with business applications.
So how does one achieve innovation in business software development?
There's an amazing wealth of literature on this topic. I will share with you what has been successful with me. I would say the top three strategies are to keep projects small, take a grassroots approach, and always be results-oriented. There was an excellent meta-analysis done of software development projects, and it showed that as the size of the project grew, as measured in function points, the cost grew exponentially. Flipping this around, by keeping projects small, you boost their chance of success exponentially. Large projects can be broken down into discrete modules. By treating each module as a standalone package, you gain reusability, maintenance benefits, and cost and risk reductions. I heard one successful CIO of a large company say he arbitrarily chose $100,000 as the cap for development projects. Now, one of the side effects of small projects is the governance changes in favor of innovation. For example, in large enterprise projects, many decisions are made by committee and require buy-in and compromise from diverse groups. Then security and privacy, legal, HR, marketing, and who have you will overlay their requirements. As a project manager architect, if you discover that you wish to make a change, it is very costly and cumbersome to revisit a decision. In small projects, this overhead largely evaporates, paving the way for more experimentation and innovation. As these small projects achieve legs and demonstrate their potential, then enterprise best practices can be introduced on an as-required basis. In a similar vein, grassroots projects avoid much of the heavy overhead of enterprise projects. And most importantly, the people who lead grassroots projects are the ones who will actually use and benefit from the solution. My friend, Kareem Keshavji, is a practicing family doctor. He recently wrote a lengthy article in Canadian Healthcare Technology detailing how eHealth Ontario is not embracing the clinicians they are building their solutions for. Kareem shared with me the feedback he received from his colleagues, other doctors. Suffice it to say, Kareem had resounding support from other doctors who are frustrated with solutions being thrust on them that don't address their needs and their pain points. My final point is a simple one. Maintain focus on the objectives. This is what I earlier called a results orientation. Again, with large projects, divisions of tasks and specialization is natural. However, each individual is focused on their contribution, and it is easy to lose sight of the big picture. There's a large international study on the impact of cell phones on brain tumors, which was recently completed. The lead ethicist doctor in Quebec was just this past week publicly criticizing the outcomes of the study, saying that privacy trumped health and consequently skewed the results. He argued that the privacy individuals knew only privacy, and as such were not able to look at the big picture and determine where or even how to compromise. I cannot comment on this particular case. As is most often the case, I suspect the compromise needs to be bilateral. However, the underlying message is clear. Had everyone been focused on the objectives, they would have found a way to reconcile their differences to the ultimate benefit of the program.
Well, that's fascinating, your comments and insights. Now, as a longtime healthcare industry contributor and innovator, what do you see as the burning issues and one of your final recommendations?
Once again, you raise a very important question, and this one is being asked across the developed world. It is clear that our current model of healthcare is unsustainable. This year in Ontario, we are spending 50% of our GDP on healthcare. At current trends, we are expecting to hit 70% in 12 years. This has an adverse reach far beyond health. I read yesterday that the public school system is severely underfunded and running an illegal deficit. Community programs, social services, public infrastructure are all going to suffer if we don't tame the healthcare dragon today. Today. While there's no single silver bullet, there are plenty of things we can do, starting from the simple, such as implementing the checklist I talked about earlier, to mimicking TPS, the Toyota Production System, which treats patient flows in hospitals similar to an assembly line. This has proven to be highly successful in uncovering wasted steps, inconsistencies, and overall driving out inefficiencies. We've also touched on clinician buy-in, results orientation, social media and gaming mechanics, as well as a host of other opportunities. There's much more I could say on this topic, but that's a conversation for another day.
Adam, you know, we're coming to the close of this interview, so I'm going to ask you a few or a couple more questions. And one of them is there's this UN-founded International Federation for Information Processing, or IFIP. And back in 2006, they decided to launch a global implementation program for worldwide professionalism and professional certification, in essence, trying to create a profession out of IT to kind of sort of like match what we have in the legal area, medicine, accounting, and so on. And this was implemented in 2009, last year, in fact. And the program is called the IP3 program, or International Professional Practice Partnership Program. What are your feelings and comments about having IT as a profession and this global professionalism program?
As somebody who's chosen to dedicate their professional career to IT and IT solutions within the business community, for me, this is incredibly important, and I fully support anything we as an industry do to mature and bring consistency and reliability to what we offer. I fully support IFIP and the IP3 initiatives. I look forward to what that means in Canada, to Canadian society in particular, as IT becomes more consistent and reliable. And also, one of the other benefits it provides is mobility for IT practitioners, being able to move from country to country as is a standard benchmark of what it means to be an IT professional.
And I guess in addition to that, and a little bit sort of not related to IT and business, and Adam, you're such a busy person. What do you do to relax?
Well, I mentioned earlier I've got my family, and my daughters are young, and I love spending time with them. Recently, I picked up running. One of those odd things, when I was younger, I hated running. Now, I discovered I'm actually not too bad at it, and I love it. And one of the most relaxing things for me is to go for a long run with my best friend, who picked it up with me, or with one of my younger daughters who will ride along on their bikes with me. It's a great way just to shut off the mind and relax. And you know what I got to point out? It's one of the other things that I do when I go on lengthy runs by myself is I'll take the MP3 player with me and I'll listen to one of your podcasts. And it's another great way to keep myself educated on current trends.
You know what? I wasn't going to do this, but I'm going to ask one more question. What's your favorite gadget?
Oh, boy. I need to think about that for a minute. There's so many great gadgets out there. I'm going to say the smartphone. I'm not going to pick on any particular vendor. I think the primary vendors, Apple, RIM, Microsoft, all have excellent products, all have their own strengths and weaknesses. But overall, the smartphone is terrific. It's an MP3 player. It's an email device. It's a contact organizer. It's got it's GPS, maps, you name it. One of the things I just discovered that my smartphone has is a business card scanner. When I hold the camera over a business card, it takes a snapshot, and I didn't even realize it has an OCR engine built into it, and it's got, I have to say, pretty good capabilities of converting the business card into the appropriate text fields. It has to be one device that I can't live without. So I'll say it, that's smartphone is my favorite gadget.
You know, it's interesting. There was a billion mobile phones sold last year, and the fastest growing segment of the mobile phone marketplace is actually smartphones. And you know what? I have to agree. I couldn't live now without my smartphone.
Yeah. Well, they don't call it a crackberry for nothing.
Right. And when you consider that there's 4 billion mobile phones out there, so, you know, and it's a great sort of equalizer. And when I talk to different people, they're saying in the center of Africa, and no matter where you go, there's people with phones. And, of course, all of them are becoming more and more capable, that is, the phones themselves. And, you know, everybody's gaining Internet access and so on. And there's this sort of kind of hypothesis is that if you enable a developing nation with the wireless technology and enable the use of these kind of mobile devices, that it contributes to the GDP faster than building things like infrastructure and so on. So it just shows you the power of technology and, of course, of mobile phones and then finally smartphones.
Yes, yes, I've heard the same, and it's about the developing nations, and it's true, and it's such an important area where we in the developed world, in Canada in particular, can provide aid in the technology experience.
Well, Adam, you know, with your extensive history of global successes in entrepreneurship, technology, innovation, leadership, and significant societal contributions, we are really fortunate to have you come in today and do this interview, so thank you.
Thank you, Stephen. It's been my pleasure. I hope some of my experiences and life lessons are helpful to others.
I'm Stephen Ibraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Adam Cole, internationally awarded technology executive and serial innovator. Adam spoke on entrepreneurship, global industry contribution and volunteerism, keys to continuing innovation, software development, project management, process innovation, relationships management, consulting, teaching, writing, graduate education, and healthcare trends and challenges.